deal more than $50. It might even be $100. The sight of it made her feel tired. No matter what plans she made or how she tried to live, some man would always be looking at her and holding out money. Without giving it much thought, Mosby had started something that nothing seemed to stop. She thought Jake had stopped it, but he hadn't. His talk about killing men was just talk. If he had cared that much, he would have shot Gus, friend or no friend. "Please, I need you." At least it might calm him down, she thought, opening the door. "I ain't messing this bed," she said. "It's the last sheet." He put the money on her little chest of drawers and turned to her. Lori shut the door and leaned against it, lifting her shift. Soon his legs were trembling so she was afraid he would collapse before he was done. But he didn't. When he finished, he put his head against her bosom for a moment, wetting her breasts with his tears even as she felt his drip on her thigh. Then he stepped back and pulled up his pants. "Goodbye," he said. "Well, I ain't left yet," she said. "We're not going till afternoon." His look startled her. It was like the look in her pa's eyes when he died in Baton Rouge. She watched him go down the stairs. He went slowly, as if feeling for each stair. He had scarcely been in her room 2 minutes, but her shift was wet with tears. Men were all strange. When he finally made it to the bottom, she turned and hid the money. It was just one more secret she had from Jake.
Chapter 22.
Late that afternoon, as the boys were sitting around Bolivar's cook fire getting their evening grub, Augustus looked up from his plate and saw Jake and Lorena ride into camp. They were riding two good horses and leading a pack horse. The most surprising thing was Lorena was wearing pants. So far as he could remember, he had never seen a woman in pants, and he considered himself a man of experience. Call had his back turned and hadn't seen them, but some of the cowboys had. The sight of a woman in pants scared them so bad they didn't know where to put their eyes. Most of them began to concentrate heavily on the beans in their plates. Dish Boget turned white as a sheet, got up without a word to anybody, and got his night horse and started out for the herd, which was strung out up the valley. It was Dish's departure that got Call's attention. He looked around and saw the couple coming. "We got you to thank for this," he said to Gus. "I admit, I was inspired," Augustus said. He knew his friend was in a silent fury, but he himself thought the visit might provide a little amusement. It had been in short supply lately. The only thing that there had been to laugh at was Alan O'Brien getting pitched into a pile of prickly pears by a bronc. When he emerged, he even had thorns in his beard. But that was a normal hazard, the horses being unreliable and the prickly pear abundant. A woman in pants was far more unusual. Jake rode right up to the cook fire, though Augustus could tell from his manner he was nervous. "Howdy, boys," he said. "Mind if we make a meal?"
"Course not. You're as welcome around here as money, Jake," Augustus said. "You and Laurie, too."
Call watched the proceedings silently, unable to decide who he was more aggravated at, Gus or Jake. Surely the latter knew better than to bring a woman into a cow camp. It was difficult enough to keep men peaceful, even if they didn't have a woman to argue about.
"Woodrow, you know Laurie, I reckon," Jake said, although he knew it wasn't true.
Call's silence had always made him nervous.
"We've not met," Call said, touching his hat but not looking at the woman.
He didn't want to get angry at Jake in front of all the hands. And all but Dish and the two Rainey boys were lounging around eating their evening meal, or at least they had been lounging. Now they were sitting as stiffly as if they were in church. Some looked paralyzed. For a moment, the only sound in camp was the jingle of a bit as the woman's horse slung its head. Augustus walked over to help Lorena dismount. The sight of the boys all sitting around like statues made him want to laugh. The sudden appearance of a Comanche would not have affected them as much. He recognized the brown mare Lori rode as having belonged to Mary Pumphrey, the young widow.
"I would not have thought Mary would give up her mare," he said.
"Jake bought her," Lorena said, grateful that Gus had come over to offer her help. Jake had not so much as looked at her since they rode into camp. She had never seen Captain Call up close before, but she could tell Jake was mighty uneasy about him. It depressed her a little that she was left to depend on Gus's courtesy from the very outset. He took her over to the cook fire and saw that she got a good helping of food, talking casually all the while, mainly about the qualities of the Pumphrey mare. Jake followed and got some grub, but he was silent when he did it. Still, it had felt good to ride out of Lonesome Dove. The dry bean had been empty as they made their preparations. The pants had been Jake's idea. He had known a woman mule skinner in Montana who had worn pants. While Jake had been fixing the pack horse, Lippy had come out on the steps of the saloon and waved his lip at her one more time. "I'll never tolt on you, Laurie," he said. He looked like he might cry, too. "You'll just have to cry," she thought. He took his bowler off and turned it around and around in his hand till it made her nervous.
"You'll have to pardon the grub," Augustus said. "Bull has learned to season, but he forgot to learn to cook."
Bolivar was resting comfortably against a wagon wheel and ignored the sally. He was wavering in his mind whether to stay or go. He did not like to travel. The thought of it made him unhappy, and yet, when he went home to Mexico, he felt unhappy too, for his wife was disappointed in him and let him know it every day. He had never been sure what she wanted. After all, their children were beautiful, but whatever it was, he had not been able to give it to her. His daughters were his delight, but they would soon all marry and be gone, leaving him no protection from his wife. Probably he would shoot his wife if he went home. He had shot an irritating horse right out from under himself. A man's patience sometimes simply snapped. He had shot the horse right between the ears, and then found it difficult to get the saddle off once the horse fell. Probably he would shoot his wife in the same way if he went home. Many times he had been tempted to shoot one or another of the members of the Hat Creek outfit, but of course, if he did that, he would be immediately shot in return. Every day he thought he might go home, but he didn't. It was easier to stay and cut up a few snakes into the cook pot than listen to his wife complain. So he stayed, day by day, paying no attention to what anyone said. That in itself was a luxury he wouldn't have at home, for a disappointed woman was not easy to ignore. Jake ate without tasting his food, wishing he had never come back to Lonesome Dove. It was going to be no pleasure riding north, if Call was so disapproving. He had meant to take Call aside and quietly explain it, but somehow he could not think of the best words to use. Call's silences had a way of making him lose track of his thoughts, some of which were perfectly good thoughts in their way. As they ate, the dusk deepened. Sean O'Brien on the far side of the herd began to sing his night song, an Irish melody whose words did not carry across the long plain where the cattle stood. But in the still of the night, the sound carried. Somehow it made Newt want to cry. He was sitting stiffly only a few feet from Lorena. He had been looking at her closely for the first time, hardly daring to, and yet feeling that he was safe because of the dusk. She was more beautiful than he had imagined, but she did not look happy. It gave him a painful feeling to see her unhappiness, and the song made it worse. His eyes filled up. It was no wonder Sean cried so much, Newt thought. His songs made you want to cry even when you couldn't hear the words.
"This is a lucky herd," Augusta said.
"And how is that?" Jake asked, a little testy. In some moods he could tolerate Gus's talk, but at other times the very sound of Gus's voice made him want to take out a gun and shoot the man. It was a loud voice. The sound of it made it hard to think, when it wasn't easy to think anyway. But the most aggravating aspect to it was that Gus always sounded cheerful, as if there was no trouble in the world that could catch him. At times when life seemed all trouble, the sight of Gus, untouched by all that went on around him, was difficult to bear.
"Why, it's the only herd on the trail that's got two Irish baritones to sing to it," Augustus said.
"He sings too sad," Needle Nelson said, for the sound of Sean's voice affected him as it had Newt. It brought to mind his mother, who had died when he was 8, and also a little sister he had been fond of, who had succumbed to a fever when only 4.
"It's the Irish nature," Augustus said.
"No, it's just Sean," Alan O'Brien said. "He's just a crybaby." Call came walking over. He felt he had to know what Jake meant to do. "Well, Jake, have you made your plans?" he asked, being as formal as possible.
"Oh, we've decided to try our luck in Denver for a time being," Jake said. "I believe we'd both enjoy the cool weather."
"It's a hard trip," Call observed.
"Why tell that to Jake?" Augustus asked. "He's a traveled man, ain't put off by hardships. Feather beds ain't his style."
He had meant it as blatant irony, since, of course, feather beds were exactly Jake's style, but the discussion was so solemn that his flourish went unnoticed.
"We had hoped to sort of ease along with a bunch of you," Jake said, his eyes down. "We'll make our own camp, so as not to be in the way. Might could help out a little if things get tight. Water might be a little chancy once we hit the plains."
"If I'd liked water better, I guess I'd have stayed a riverboater. You boys would have missed out on some choice conversation over the years," Augustus said.
"Hell, it's taken 10 years off my life listening to you talk," Jake said.
"Jake, you are surly tonight," Augustus said mildly. "I guess leaving the easy pickings around here has put you out of sorts."
P.I. was carefully wetting his bowie knife on the sole of one boot. Though they were still perfectly safe, as far as he knew, P. had already begun to have bad dreams about the big Indian whose ferocity had haunted him in his sleep for years. The dreams had been so bad that he had already started sleeping with the unsheathed bowie knife in his hand, so he would be in the habit of it by the time they hit Indian country. This precaution caused certain problems for the young hands, whose duty it was to wake him for his shift at night herding. It put them in danger of getting stabbed, a fact which troubled Jasper Fant particularly. Jasper was sensitive to danger. Usually he chose to wake P by kicking him in one foot, although even that wasn't really safe. P was tall, and who knew when he might snap up and make a lunge. Jasper had concluded that the best way would be to pelt him with small rocks, although such caution would only earn him the scorn of the rest of the hands.
"I wouldn't have wanted to miss hearing you talk, Gus," P said, though he could not offhand remember a single thing Gus had ever said over the years. But he could remember, night after night, drowsing off to the sound of Gus's voice.
"But I'm ready to start, if we got to start," Augustus said. "We got enough cattle now to stock 5 ranches.
Call knew that was true, but he found it difficult to resist running over to Mexico every few nights to add more cattle. They were easy to get without Pedro Flores to contend with.
"It does seem a pity you're so independent, Jake," Augustus said. "If you come in with us, you could be a cattle baron yet."
"No, I'd rather be poor than chew the dust," Jake said, standing up. Lori stood up, too. She felt her silence coming back. It was men watching her while trying to pretend they weren't watching her that brought it on. Few of them were bold enough just to look straight at her. They had to be sneaky about it. Being among them in the camp was worse than the saloon, where at least she had a room. In the camp, there was nothing she could do but sit and listen to the talk pass her by.
"I guess we'll try to find a ridge to camp on," Jake said. "It would be nice to be upwind from these smelly beasts."
"Good God, Jake, if you're that finicky, you ought to have been a barber," Augustus said. "Then you could smell hair oil and toilet water all day and never be offended."
He walked over and helped Lorena mount, The brown mare was restless and kept slinging her head. "I may take to barbering yet," Jake said, annoyed that Gus had seen fit to help Lori again. She was going to have to learn to mount sometime, with over 1,000 miles of riding ahead.
"I hope you'll come back for breakfast," Augusta said. "We eat about an hour before sunrise. Woodrow Call likes to put in a full day, as you may remember."
"For that matter, we intend to have our breakfast sent out by the hotel," Jake said sarcastically, spurring his horse. Call watched them go, annoyed. Augustus noticed and chuckled.
"Even you can't stop inconvenient things from happening, Carl," he said. "Jake can only be controlled up to a point, and Laura's a woman. She can't be controlled at all."
Carl didn't want to argue about it. He picked up his Henry and walked out of the circle of firelight, meaning to have a few minutes to himself. Passing behind the wagon, he bumped into Newt, who had evidently been holding his water while a woman was in camp and had just slipped off to relieve himself. "Sorry, Captain," he said.
"You ought to go get Dish," Carl said. "I don't know why he rode off. It ain't his shift. I guess we'll start tomorrow. We can't take all the cattle in Mexico."
He stood silently a moment. The mood to walk had left him. Newt was surprised. The captain never shared his decisions with him, and yet it seemed that the decision to leave had just been made, right there behind the wagon. "Captain," he asked, "how far is it up north?" It was something he couldn't stop wondering about, and since the captain hadn't walked away, the question just popped out. He immediately felt silly for asking it. "I guess it's a mighty far piece up north," he said, as if to relieve the captain of the need to answer. It struck Call that they should have educated the boy a little better. He seemed to think north was a place, not just a direction. It was another of Gus's failings. He considered himself a great educator, and yet he rarely told anyone anything they needed to know. "It's a ways further than you've been," Call said, not sure the boy had ever been anywhere. Probably they had at least taken him to Pickle's Gap at some point. "Oh, I've been north," Newt said, not wanting the captain to think him completely untraveled. "No, I've been north, clear to San Antone. Remember?" Call remembered then. Dietz had taken him once. "Where we're going is a sight farther," he said.
Chapter 23.
"Well, I'm going to miss Wants," Augustus said,
as he and Call were eating their bacon in the faint morning light.
"Plus, I already miss my Dutch ovens. You would want to move just as my sourdough got right at its prime."
"I'd like to think that there's a better reason for living in a place than you being able to cook biscuits," Call said. "Though I admit they're good biscuits."
"You ought to admit it. You've had enough of them. I still think we ought to just hire the town and take it with us. Then we'd have a good barkeep and somebody to play the pianna."
With Call suddenly determined to leave that very day, Augustus found himself regretful, nostalgic already for things he hadn't particularly cared for but hated to think of losing.
"What about the well?" he asked. "Another month and we'd have had it dug."
"We?" Call asked. "When did you hit a lick on that well?"
He looked around and saw, to his astonishment, that Augustus's two pigs were laying under the wagon, snuffling. In the half-dark, he had thought it was Bolivar snoring.
"Who asked them darn pigs?" he said.
"I guess the tractus," Augustus said. "They are enterprising pigs."
"I guess you're planning to take them, too."
"It's still a free country. They can come if they want the inconvenience. Wonder where Jake camped."
At that point, the late shift came riding in. Newt, P., Dish Boget, and Jasper Flant, plus a fifth man who hadn't been part of the shift.
"Why, it's Soupy Jones," Call said.
"God almighty," Augustus said. "The man must have lost his wits.
What few he had. Soupy had rangered with them a few months before they quit. He was brave but lazy, a fine card player, and by all odds the best horseman any of them had ever known. His love of being horseback was so strong that he could seldom be induced to dismount, except to sleep or eat. I thought Soupy married, Call said, as the boys unsaddled their night horses. That was the gossip, Augusta said. Married a rich woman and became a sheriff, I heard. Well, maybe she run off with the preacher. If she didn't, I don't know why he's out here this time of night. Soupy, a short man, came walking over with P.I. Look what rode up, P.I. said. I near mistook him for a bandit since it was pitch dark. "'Ay, God, Soupy, you should have waited till we lit the lantern,' Augustus said, standing up to shake hands. "'A sharp bunch of gun hands like us, you're lucky not to be shot.' "'Oh, Gus,' Soupy said, not knowing what else to say. He had always been nonplussed by Gus's witticisms. "'Morning, Captain,' he said, as Call shook his hand. "'Have some grub,' Call said. He had always been fond of the man, despite his unwillingness to dismount if there was something to do on the ground.
"'Where'd you come from, Soupy?' Augustus asked. "'Didn't we hear you was mayor of some place, or was it governor?'
"'I was just in Bastrop, Gus,' Soupy said. "'Bastrop don't have no mayor, or governor either. It's barely a town.'
"'Well, we're barely an outfit.' Though we got two fine pigs that just joined us last night. Are you looking for employment?
Yes. My wife died, Soupy said. She was never strong, he added, in the silence that followed the remark. Well, you're hired at least, Call said.
I lost two wives myself, Augustus remarked.
I heard Jake was around, but I don't see him, Soupy said. He and Jake had been close buddies once, and it was partly curiosity about him that made Soupy want to rejoin the Hat Creek outfit. "'Well, he is,' Call said, not anxious to have to explain the situation.
"'Jake won't camp with us old cobs,' Augustus said. "'He's traveling with the valet, if you know what I mean.'
"'No, but if it's traveling with Jake, I bet it wears skirts,' Soupy said. A remark which for some reason seemed to catch everybody wrong, or everybody but Gus, who laughed long and hard, feeling a little confused but happy to have been hired. Soupy went off with P.I. to get breakfast.
"'I'm going in and pry up that sign I wrote so we can take it with us,' Augusta said. "'I may pry up one of my Dutch ovens and bring it, too.'
"'Bowl ain't said that he's going,' Call said. It was a mild anxiety. If Bowl quit and they had to depend on Gus to do the cooking, the whole trip would be in jeopardy. Apart from biscuits, his cooking was of the sort that caused tempers to flare. In fact, Bolivar was standing by the cook fire, staring into it with an expression of deep gloom. If he'd heard the remark, he gave no sign.
"'Oh, Bowl's got the adventure spirit,' Augusta said. "'He'll go, and if he don't, he'll just have to go home and wed his wife more often than he cares to.'
With that, he went and got the two mules that constituted their wagon team. The bigger mule, a gray, was named Greasy, and the smaller, a bay, they called Kickboy, out of respect for his lightning rear hooves. They had not been worked very much, there seldom having been a need to take the wagon anywhere. It was theoretically for rent, but rarely got rented more than once a year. Greasy and Kickboy were an odd-looking team, the former being nearly four hands higher than the latter. Augustus hitched them to the wagon while Call went to inspect the remuda, meaning to weed out any horses that looked sickly.
"'Don't weed out too many,' Augustus said. "'We might need to eat 'em.'
Dish Boget, who had had little sleep and had not enjoyed the little, found the remark irritating. "'Why would we need to eat the darn horses with 3,000 cattle right in front of us?' he asked. He had spent hours riding around the herd with a tight wad of anger in his breast.
"I can't say, Dish," Augusta said. "We might want to change our fare, for all I know, or the Sioux Indians might run off the cattle. Of course, they might run off the horses, too."
"What happened to us in that stonehouse fight?" P remarked. "They set fire to the grass, and I couldn't see a darn thing."
"Well, I ain't you," Dish informed him. "I bet I could see my own horse, fire or no fire."
"I'm going to town," Augusta said. "You boys will stand and jabber all day. Any of you want anything brought, it has to be something that will fit in this wagon."
"Bring me $500. That'll fit," Jasper said. There was a general laughter, which Augustus ignored.
"What I ought to bring is a few coffins," he said. "Most of you boys will probably be drowned before we hit the Powder River."
"Bring a few jugs if you see any," Jasper said. The fear of drowning was strong in him, and Gus's remark spoiled his mood.
"Jasper, I'll bring a boat if I notice one," Augusta said.
He caught Bolivar staring at him malevolently.
"Come on, if you're coming, Bol," he said. "No reason for you to go north and drown."
Bol was indeed feeling terrible. They only talked of going, not of coming back. It might be he would never see Mexico again, or his lovely daughters, if he left. And yet, when he looked across the river and thought of his village, he just felt tired. He was too tired to deal with a disappointed woman, and much too tired to be abandoned. Instead of climbing in the wagon, he turned away and sat down near the pigs. They had found a cool spot where the water barrel had dripped, and they were lying on their stomachs watching the proceedings alertly.
"If I ain't back in a month, you girls feel free to start without me," Augusta said.
Then he drove off, amused that Dish Bogart looked so out of sorts just from being in love with a woman who didn't want him. It was a peril too common to take seriously. A half mile from the main camp, he came upon the very woman who had given Dish the pain. She was attempting to cook some fry back and was getting no help from Jake Spoon, who hadn't even provided her with a good fire. Jake was sitting on his bedding, his hair sticking up in the back, trying to dig a thorn out of his hand with a pocket knife. Augusta stopped the team and got down to chat a minute.
"Jake, you look like you slept standing on your head," he said. "Is that a bullet you're digging out? Has she shot you already?"
"Who invited you for breakfast?" Jake said.
"Ivette," Augusta said. "Well, I just stopped by to set the table so you two could dine in style."
"Hello, Gus," Laurie said. "Don't start no conversation, else he'll stay all day," Jake said. "I'd forgotten what a pest you are, Gus." He had got the thorn in his thumb hobbling the horses the night before and had been unable to get it out in the dark. Now his thumb was swollen to twice its size, for a green mesquite thorn was only slightly less poisonous than a rattlesnake. Besides, he had slept badly on the stony ground, and Laurie had refused him again, when all he wanted was a little pleasure to take his mind off his throbbing thumb. They were camped only 2 miles from town, and could easily have ridden back and slept comfortably in the dry bean. But when he suggested it, Laurie showed her stubborn streak and refused. He could go back if he cared to. She wasn't. So he had stayed and slept poorly, worrying most of the night about snakes. As much camping as he had done, it was a fear that never left him.
"It's a wonder you ain't froze to death years ago, if that's the best fire you can make," Augusta said.
He began to gather sticks. "You don't need to bother," Lorena said. "I've already burned the meat." It was good Gus had stopped, for Jake was in a temper already. Just because she had turned away from him the night before, he had a quick pride, and any refusal made him angry. As for sleeping on the ground, she didn't mind. It was at least fairly cool.
"I never expected to find you still in bed at this hour, Jake," Augusta said. "You'll have a time keeping up with us if you don't improve your habits. By the way, Soupy hired on this morning, and he inquired about you."
"There goes the easy money," Jake said. "Soupy will win every cent you boys can earn in the next 10 years. He's been known to win from me, and that ain't easy." Well, I'm going to town, Augusta said. Want me to pick you up a Bible or a few hymn books?
No, we're leaving, Jake said. Soon as we pack.
That won't be soon, Augusta said. You've scattered stuff over 3 acres, just making this one little camp.
That was true. They had unpacked in the dark and made a mess of it. Jake was looking for a whiskey bottle that wasn't where he thought he'd put it. It was plain camping wasn't a neat way of life. There was no place to wash, and they were carrying very little water, which was the main reason she had refused Jake. She liked to wash and felt he could wait until they camped near a river and could splash a little of the dust off before bedding down. Augustus watched them eat the poor, burned breakfast. It was eternally amusing, the flow of human behavior. Who could have predicted Jake would be the one to take Lorena out of Lonesome Dove? She had been meaning to leave since the day she arrived, and now Jake, who had slipped from the grasp of every woman who had known him, was firmly caught by a young whore from Alabama. The quality of determination had always intrigued him. Lori had it, and Jake didn't. Hers was nothing compared to W.F. Call's, but hers would probably be sufficient to get her to San Francisco, where no doubt she would end up a respectable woman. After accepting a cup of coffee from Lori, he took a look at Jake's thumb, which was swollen and turning white.
You better be sure you got all that thorn out, Gus said. If you don't, you'll probably lose the hand, and maybe the arm that goes with it.
I won't lose no arm, and if I did, I could still beat you dealing one-handed, Jake said. I hope you invite us to breakfast one of these days to repay the favor. When Augustus reached Lonesome Dove, the one street was still and empty, with only one horse twitching its tail in front of the Pumphrey store. The dust his wagon stirred hung straight as a column before settling back into the street. Augustus stopped in front of the deserted blacksmith shop. The blacksmith, an uncommunicative man named Roy Royce, had ridden out of town some months before and had not come back. Augustus found a small crowbar among the tools a man had cavalierly abandoned and rode up the street to the Hat Creek Corrals, where he easily pried the sign off the fence. The Dutch ovens were more resistant. They showed signs of crumbling, so he left them. There would be no time for leisurely biscuit-making on their trail anyway. He walked through the house and had a look at the roofless barn, amused at how little trace remained of their 10 years' residence. They had lived the whole time as if they meant to leave at any minute, and now that was exactly what they had done. The barn would stay roofless, the well only partially dug. The rattlesnakes could take the spring house for all he cared. He had already removed his whiskey jug. It would be a while before he had such a good shady porch to sit on, drinking the afternoon out. In Texas, he had drunk to take his mind off the heat. In Montana, no doubt, it would be to take his mind off the cold. He didn't feel sad. The one thing he knew about Texas was that he was lucky to be leaving it alive, and in fact, he had a long way to go before he could be sure of accomplishing that much. He drove down to the saloon. At first, he thought the saloon was empty, but then he saw Xavier Wands sitting at a table near the shadowy end of the bar. He had not bothered to shave for 2 days, a sign of profound demoralization.
"Darn, Wants! You look poorly," Augustus said. "I see the morning rush ain't started yet."
"It will never start."
"Just because you lost your whore don't mean the sun won't rise again," Augustus assured him. "Take a trip to San Antonio and recruit another whore."
"I would have married her."
"I ain't surprised," Augustus said gently.
There were men who didn't get over women. He himself, fortunately, was not one of them, though he had felt fairly black for a year after Clara married. "I would have taken her to San Francisco. I would have given her money, bought her clothes."
"In my opinion, the woman made a poor bargain," Augustus said. "I've seen her not an hour ago trying to cook over a darn smoky fire. But then we don't look at life like women do, Wants. They don't always appreciate convenience."
It had seemed a miracle the day she walked in the door with nothing but her beauty. From the first, he had planned to marry her someday. It didn't matter that she was a whore. She had intelligence. And he felt sure her intelligence would one day guide her to him. She would see, in time, how much kinder he was than other men. She would recognize that he treated her better, loved her more. Yet it hadn't worked. She went with him willingly enough when he requested it, but no more willingly than she went with other men. Then Jake had come and taken her, just taken her, as easily as picking a hat off a rack. But when he offered, she had merely shaken her head, and now his dreams were ruined. He remembered that when he declared his love, her eyes hadn't changed at all. It was as if he had suggested she sweep out the bar. She had only tolerated him to avoid a scene with Jake, and had seemed scarcely aware that he had given her nearly $200, four times as much as Gus. It was enough to buy her passage to San Francisco, but she had merely taken it and shut the door. It was cruel, love.
"Well, it's too bad you ain't a cowboy," Augustus said. "You look like you could use a change of air. Where's Lippy?"
The last thing that would interest him was the whereabouts of Lippy. Augustus drank a glass, but said no more. "If Jake gets killed, tell her I will come." There was always that prospect. After all, he had only met Teresa because her first husband had fallen off a roof and broken his neck. A man like Jake, a traveler and a gambler, might meet a violent end at any time.
"I doubt it'll happen," Augustus said,
not wishing to encourage faint hopes. When he went out, he found Lippy sitting in the wagon with his bowler on his head.
"How'd you get in my wagon?" Augustus asked.
"Jumped off the roof, and this is where I landed," Lippy said. He liked the joke.
"Well, jump back on the roof, then," Augustus said. "I'm going to Montana."
"Well, I'm hiring on," Lippy said. "The piano playing's over around here. Waltz won't feed me, and I can't cook. I'll starve to death."
"It might beat drowning in the Republican River," Augustus said.
Lippy had a little bag packed and sitting between his feet. It was clear he was packed and ready.
"Let's go," he said. "Well, we got two Irishmen. I guess we can always use a man with a hole in his stomach," Augustus said.
Lippy had been a fair horseman once. Maybe Call would let him look after the remuda. As they rode out of town, the Widow Cole was hanging out her washing. Hot as the sun was, it seemed to Augustus it would be dry before she got it on the line. She kept a few goats, one of which was nibbling on the rope handle of her laundry basket. She was an imposing woman, and he felt a pang of regret that he and she had not gotten on better. But the truth was they fell straight into argument, even if they only happened to meet in the street. Probably her husband, Joe Cole, had bored her for 20 years, leaving her with a taste for argument. He himself enjoyed argument, but not with a woman who had been bored all her life. It could lead to a strenuous existence. As they passed out of town, Lippy suddenly turned sentimental. Under the blazing sun, the town looked white. The only things active in it were the widow and her goats. There were only about 10 buildings, hardly enough to make a town, but Lippy got sentimental anyway. He remembered when there had been another saloon, one that kept 5 Mexican whores. He had gone there often and had great fun in the days before he got the wound in his belly. He had never forgotten the merry whores. They were always sitting on his lap. One of them, a girl named Maria, would sleep with him merely because she liked the way he played the piano. Those had been the years. At the thought of them, his eyes teared up, making his last look at Lonesome Dove a watery one. The dusty street wavered in his vision as if under a heavy rain. Augustus happened to notice that Lippy was crying, tears running down both sides of his nose into the floppy pocket of his lip. Lippy normally cried when he got drunk, so the sight was nothing new. Except that he didn't seem drunk.
"If you're sick, you can't go," he said sternly. "We don't want no sickly hands."
I ain't sick, Gus, Lippy said, a little embarrassed by his tears. Soon he felt a little better. Lonesome Dove was hidden. He could barely see the top of the little church house across the Chaparral Flats. It's funny leaving a place, ain't it? He said. You never do know when you'll get back.
Chapter 24.
Although he knew they wouldn't leave until the heat of the day was over, Newt felt so excited that he didn't miss sleep and could hardly eat. The captain had made it final. They were leaving that day. He had told all the hands that they ought to see to their equipment. Once they got on the trail, opportunities for repair work might be scarce. In fact, the advice only mattered to the better-equipped hands, Dish, Jasper, Soupy Jones, and Needle Nelson. The Speddle brothers, for example, had no equipment at all, unless you called one pistol with a broken hammer equipment. Newt had scarcely more. His saddle was an old one, and he had no slicker and only one blanket for a bedroll. The Irishman had nothing except what they had been loaned. P seemed to think the only important equipment was his Bowie knife, which he spent the whole day sharpening. Dietz merely got a needle and some pieces of rawhide and sewed a few rawhide patches on his old quilted pants. When they saw Mr. Augustus ride up with Lippy, some of the hands thought it might be a joke, but the captain at once put him in charge of the horses, an action that moved Dish Bogat to scorn. "Half the remuda will run off once they see him flop that lip," he said. Augustus was inspecting the feet of his main horse, a large buckskin he called Old Malaria, not a graceful mount, but a reliable one. "It might surprise you, Dish," he said. "But Lippy was once a considerable hand. I wouldn't talk if I were you. You may end up with a hole in your stomach and have to play at whorehouse piano for a living." "If I do, I'll starve," Dish said. "I've never had the opportunity of piano lessons." Once it was clear he was not going to be constantly affronted by the sight of Jake and Lorena, Dish's mood improved a little. Since they were traveling along the same route, an opportunity might yet arise to demonstrate that he was a better man than Jake Spoon. She might need to be saved from a flood or a grizzly bear. Grizzly bears were often the subject of discussion around the campfire at night. No one had ever seen one, but all agreed they were almost impossible to kill. Jasper Fant had taken to worrying about them constantly, if only as a change from worrying about drowning. Jasper's obsession with drowning had begun to impress them all. He had talked so much about it that Newt had come to feel it would be almost a miracle if someone didn't drown at every river. "Well, if we see one of them bears, peek and stick him with that knife he keeps sharpening," Bert Borum said. "It ought to be sharp enough to kill a darn elephant by now." P took the criticism lightly. "Never hurts to be ready," he said, quoting an old saying of the captain's. Call himself spent the day on the mare, weeding out the weaker stock, both cattle and horses. He worked with Dietz. About noon they were resting under a big mesquite tree. Dietz was watching a little Texas bull mount a cow not far away. The little bull hadn't come from Mexico. He had wandered in one morning, unbranded, and had immediately whipped three larger bulls that attempted to challenge him. He was not exactly rainbow-colored, but his hide was mottled to an unusual extent, part brown, part red, part white, and with a touch here and there of yellow and black. He looked a sight, but he was all bull. Much of the night he could be heard baying. The Irishmen had come to hate him since his baying drowned out their singing. In fact, none of the cowboys liked him. He would occasionally charge a horse if his temper was up, and was even worse about men on foot. Once, Needle Nelson had dismounted, meaning to idle away a minute or two, relieving himself, and the little bull had charged him so abruptly that Needle had had to hop back on his horse while still pissing. All the hands had a fine laugh at his expense. Needle had been so angered that he wanted to rope and cut the bull, but Call intervened. Call thought the bull well made, though certainly a peculiar mix of colors, and wanted to keep him. "Let him be," he said. "We'll need some bulls in Montana." Augustus had been highly amused. "Good God, Call," he said.
You mean you want to fill this paradise we're going to with animals that look like that?
He ain't bad looking if you don't count his color, Carl said.
Be damned to his color and his disposition, too, Needle said. He knew he would be a long time living down having to mount his horse with his dingus flopping.
Well, I reckon it's time to go, Carl said to Dietz. We'll never get there if we don't start.
Dietz was not so sure they would get there anyway, but he kept his doubts to himself. The captain usually managed to do what he meant to do.
I want you to be the scout, the captain said. We got plenty of men to keep the stock moving. I want you to find us water and good bed ground every night.
Dietz nodded modestly, but inside he felt proud. Being made scout was more of an honor than having your name on a sign. It was proof that the captain thought highly of his abilities. When they got back to the wagon, Augustus was oiling his guns. Lippy fanned himself with his bowler, and most of the other hands were just sitting around wishing it were cooler.
"Have you counted the stock yet?" Carl asked Augustus.
The man possessed a rare skill when it came to counting animals. He could ride through a herd and count it, something Carl had never been able to do.
"No, I ain't got around to that task," Augustus said. "Maybe I will if you'll tell me what difference it makes."
"It would be useful to know how many we're starting out with," Carl said. "If we get there with 90%, we'll be lucky."
"Yes, lucky if we get there with 90% of ourselves," Augustus said. "It's your show, Carl. Myself, I'm just long to see the country."
Dish Boget had been dozing under the wagon. He sat up so abruptly that he bumped his head on the bottom of the wagon. He had had a terrible dream in which he had fallen off a cliff. The dream had started nice, with him riding along on the point of a herd of cattle. The cattle had become buffalo, and the buffalo had started running. Soon they began to pour over a cut bank of some kind. Dish saw it in plenty of time to stop his horse, but his horse wouldn't stop. And before he knew it, he went off the bank, too. The ground was so far below, he could barely see it. He fell and fell, and to make matters worse, his horse turned over in the air, so that Dish was upside down and on the bottom. Just as he was about to be smashed, he woke up, lathered in sweat.
"See what I mean?" Augustus said. "Dish has already cracked his noggin, and we ain't even left yet."
Carl got a plate of food and went off by himself to eat. It was something that he had always done, moved apart, so he could be alone to think things out a little. In the old days, when he first developed the habit, the men had not understood. Occasionally one would follow him, wanting to chat. But they soon learned better. Nothing made Carl sink deeper into silence than for someone to come around and start yapping when he wanted to be by himself. Virtually all his life, he had been in the position of leading groups of men, yet the truth was, he never liked groups. Men he admired for their abilities and actions most always brought themselves down in his estimation if he had to sit around and listen to them talk, or watch them drink, play cards, or run off after women. Listening to men talk usually made him feel more alone than if he were a mile away by himself under a tree. He had never really been able to take part in talk. The endless talk of cards and women made him feel more set apart, and even a little vain. If that was the best they could think of, then they were lucky they had him to lead them. It seemed immodest, but it was a thought that often came to him. And the more he stayed apart, the more his presence made the men nervous.
"It's hard for normal men to relax around you, Carl," Augustus told him once. "You ain't never been relaxed yourself, so you don't know what you're missing."
"Pshaw," Carl said. "P goes to sleep around me half the time. I guess that's relaxed."
"No, that's worn out," Augustus said. "If you didn't work him 16 hours a day, he'd be as nervous as the rest." When Carl had eaten, he took his plate back to Bolivar, who seemed to have decided to go along. He had made no move to leave, at least. Carl wanted him along, and yet somehow didn't feel quite right about it. It didn't seem proper that a man with a wife and daughters would go away without even informing them, on a journey from which he might never return.
The old pistolero didn't know the Hat Creek outfit that kind of effort, and Call reluctantly raised the subject with him.
"Bo, we're leaving today," he said. "You can have your wages if you'd rather."
Bull just looked annoyed and shook his head, didn't say a word.
"I'm glad you're with us, Bull," Augustus said. "You'll make a fine Canadian."
"What is Canada?" Charlie Rainey asked. He had never been sure.
"The land of the Northern Lights," Augustus said.
The heat had caused a dearth of conversation and made him welcome almost any question. "What's them?" the boy wondered.
"Well, they light up the sky. I don't know if you can see them from Montana."
"I wonder if we'll ever see Jake again," P.I. said. "That Jake sure don't keep still."
"He was just here yesterday. We don't need to marry him," Dish said,
unable to conceal his irritation at the mere mention of the man.
"Well, I've oiled my guns," Augustus said. "We might as well go and put the Cheyenne Nation to flight, if the army hasn't."
Call didn't answer.
"Ain't you even sorry to leave this place now that we've made it so peaceful?" Augustus asked.
"No," Call said. "We ought to have left right after we come." It was true. He had no affection for the border and a yearning for the plains, dangerous as they were.
"It's a funny life," Augustus said. "All these cattle and 9/10 of the horses is stolen, and yet we once was respected lawmen. If we get to Montana, we'll have to go into politics. You'll wind up a governor if the darn place ever gets to be a state, and you'll spend all your time passing laws against cattle thieves."
"I wish there was a law I could pass against you," Call said.
"I don't know what Wants is going to do without us."
Chapter 25.
In the late afternoon, they strung a rope corral around the remuda so each hand could pick himself a set of mounts, each being allowed 4 picks. It was slow work, for Jasper Fant and Needle Nelson could not make up their minds. The Irishman and the boys had to take what was left after the more experienced hands had chosen. Augustus did not deign to make a choice at all.
"I intend to ride old Malaria all the way," he said. "Or if not, I'll ride Greasy."
Once the horses were assigned, the positions had to be assigned as well.
"Dish, you take the right point," Call said. "Soupy can take the left, and Bert and Needle will back you up."
Dish had assumed that as top hand he would have the point, and no one disputed his right. But both Bert and Needle were unhappy that Soupy had the other point. They had been with the outfit longer and felt aggrieved. The Spettle boys were told to help Lippy with the horse herd. Newt, the Raineys, and the Irishman were left with the drags. Call saw that each of them had bandanas, for the dust at the rear of the herd would be bad. They spent an hour patching on the wagon, a vehicle Augustus regarded with scorn.
"That darn wagon won't get us to the Brazos," he said. "Well, it's the only wagon we got," Call said. "You didn't assign me no duties, nor yourself either," Augustus pointed out.
"That's simple," Call said. "I'll scare off bandits, and you can talk to Indian chiefs."
"You boys let these cattle string out," he said to the men. "We ain't in no big hurry."
Augustus had ridden through the cattle and had come back with a count of slightly over 2,600.
"Make it 2,600 cattle and 2 pigs," he said. "I guess we've seen the last of the darn Rio Grande. One of us ought to make a speech, Carl. Think of how long we've rode this river."
Carl was not willing to indulge him in any dramatics. He mounted the mare and went over to help the boys get the cattle started. It was not a hard task. Most of the cattle were still wild as antelope and instinctively moved away from the horsemen. In a few minutes they were on the trail, strung out for more than a mile. The point rider soon disappeared in the low brush. Lippy and the Spettle boys were with the wagon. With the dust so bad, they intended to keep their horses a fair distance behind. Bolivar sat on the wagon seat, his 10-gauge across his lap. In his experience, trouble usually came quick. When it came, he meant to keep the 10-gauge handy to discourage it. Newt had heard much talk of dust, but he had paid little attention to it until they actually started the cattle. Then he couldn't help noticing it, for there was nothing else to notice. The grass was sparse, and every hoof sent up its little spurt of dust. Before they had gone a mile, he himself was white with it, and for moments actually felt lost, it was so thick. He had to tie the bandana around his nose to get a good breath. He understood why Dish and the other boys were so anxious to draw assignments near the front of the herd. If the dust was going to be that bad all the way, he might as well be riding to Montana with his eyes shut. He would see nothing but his own horse and a few cattle that happened to be within 10 yards of him. A grizzly bear could walk in and eat him and his horse both, and they wouldn't be missed until breakfast the next day. But he had no intention of complaining. They were on their way, and he was part of the outfit. After waiting for the moment so long, what was a little dust? Once in a while, though, he dropped back a little. His bandana got sweaty, and the dust caked on it so that he felt that he was inhaling mud. He had to take it off and beat it against his leg once in a while. He was riding Mouse, who looked like he could use a bandana of his own. The dust seemed to make the heat worse, or else the heat made the dust worse. The second time he stopped to beat his bandana, he happened to notice Sean leaning off his horse as if he were trying to vomit. The horse and Sean were both white, as if they had been rolled in powder, though the horse Sean rode was a dark bay. "Are you hurt?" he asked anxiously. "No, I was trying to spit," Sean said. "I've got some mud in my mouth. I didn't know it would be like this."
"I didn't either," Newt said. "Well, we better keep up," he added nervously. He didn't want to neglect his responsibilities. Then, to his dismay, he looked back and saw 20 or 30 cattle standing behind them. They had ridden right past them in the dust, and he immediately loped back to get them, hoping the captain hadn't noticed. When he turned back, two of the wild heifers spooked. Mouse, a good cow horse, twisted and jumped a medium-sized chaparral bush in an effort to gain a step on the cows. Newt had not expected the jump and lost both stirrups, but fortunately diverted the heifer so that they turned back into the main herd. He found his heart was beating fast, partly because he had almost been thrown and partly because he had nearly left 30 cattle behind. With such a start, it seemed to him that he would be lucky to get to Montana without disgracing himself. Col and Augustus rode along together, some distance from the herd. They were moving through fairly open country, flats of chaparral, with only here and there a stand of mesquite. That would soon change. The first challenge would be the brush country, an almost impenetrable band of thick mesquite between them and San Antonio. Only a few of the hands were experienced in the brush, and a bad run of some kind might cost them hundreds of cattle.
"What do you think, Gus?" Call asked. "Think we can get through the brush? Or had we better go around?"
Augustus looked amused.
"Well, these cattle are like deer, only faster," he said. "They'll get through the brush fine. The problem will be the hands. Half of them will probably get their eyes poked out."
"I still don't know what you think," Call said.
"The problem is I ain't used to being consulted," Augustus said. "I'm usually sitting on the porch drinking whiskey at this hour. As for the brush, my choice would be to go through. It's that or go down to the coast and get at by the mosquitoes."
"Where do you reckon Jake will end up?" Carl asked.
"In a hole in the ground like you and me."
"I don't know why I ever ask you a question," Carl said.
"Well, the last time I seen Jake, he had a thorn in his hand," Augustus said. "He was wishing he'd stayed in Arkansas and taken his hanging."
They rode up on a little knobby hill and stood for a moment to watch the cattle. The late sun shone through the dust cloud, making the white dust rosy. The riders to each side of the herd were spread wide, giving the cattle lots of room. Most of them were horn stock, thin and light, their hides a mixture of colors. The riders at the rear were all but hidden in the rosy dust.
"Them boys on the drags won't even be able to get down from their horses unless we take a spade and spade 'em off a little," Augustus said.
"It won't hurt 'em," Carl said. "They're young." In the clear late afternoon light, they could see all the way back to Lonesome Dove and the river and Mexico. Augustus regretted not tying a jug to his saddle. He would have liked to sit on the little hill and drink for an hour. Although Lonesome Dove had not been much of a town, he felt sure that a little whiskey